Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
We're ready. I think we're ready.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, we'll start
early. Let's make a show.
Let's make a show. Hey, kids, let's put on a show.
Hey, kids.
Hey, everybody, I'm Kyle Risdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. None of us is as smart as all of us is the catchphrase around these parts.
That's right. And it's the truth. I'm Molly Wood. It's Tuesday, which means it's our day to dive deep into a single topic with a little bit of help. Today, we are talking about, as promised, the social safety net, which we generally think of as this thing that's sort of supposed to help families and kids who are experiencing poverty from feeling the most brutal effects of that poverty, things like hunger and homelessness.
In this country, which is not like other countries, as you will hear in terms of a social safety net, it was sort of Great Depression-ish, Franklin Roosevelt, when the idea that the government ought to be doing something to help people who sort of can't make it on their own. And that, you know, obviously because of the times. Over the decades since, the social safety net has broadened in meaning and actual funding, and then it has narrowed, and then it's trying to be expanded again. It's a whole long saga, which is why we're doing this thing. And mostly it's because we wanted to square it away for ourselves and help you as well.
Right. What do we mean when we say it? What actually exists versus what we sometimes think exists and what should exist that doesn't, basically. Those are our three questions in a nutshell. And here to help us answer all three of them and more is Tina Sachs, professor of social welfare at UC Berkeley. Hi, Tina.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. And I guess let's start with sort of this first overarching question. What do we even mean when we say social safety net? What are the programs that we're talking about that currently exist? What are their goals?
Sure. So the social safety net, the way I would characterize it, is it's really about providing some modicum of, of an income floor, potentially for people who are vulnerable in the United States. So we're talking about things like the earned income tax credit, child tax credits, a cash transfer program called TANF, or Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. We have programs for people who are disabled and unable to work as a result. So those are SSI, SSDI. There's the unemployment insurance system. We have food stamps or supplemental nutrition assistance program, or SNAP. We have other food programs called Women, Infants, and Children, which is to support pregnant people to get enough, proper nutrition during their pregnancies. We do a little bit in terms of energy assistance, helping people pay for heating in the winter so that they can live in an appropriately heated domicile. We have a little bit of housing assistance, and we also pay a little bit of attention to children who have been abused or neglected by paying for the child welfare system. And so all of that adds up to roughly 8% of the federal budget in a couple of years ago in 2019.
You know, it's so funny. Until you said it was just 8% of the federal budget a couple of years ago, my next question was going to be, boy, that sounds like a lot, but it really kind of isn't. And that, I guess, question still applies. That's a whole lot of programs wrapped into just 8% of the federal budget, which is a big budget, but still, it's not a whole lot.
It's very meager. or modest, depending on your persuasion. And it's relatively small relative to other programs that the federal government pays for. So, for example, about 16% of the federal budget goes to defense and international security efforts, and 23% goes to Social Security. And another 25%, another huge chunk, goes to Medicaid, Medicare, children's health insurance programs, and subsidies to the Affordable Care Act.
Wait, sorry, can I back you up for a second? So Medicaid and Medicare, do they not count as the social safety net in your, you know, considered experienced opinion?
I was wondering that too. Yeah.
No, they certainly
I even thought Social Security was part of the safety net. Totally. I'm so confused now.
It is absolutely part of what we think of sort of broadly as the social safety net, as a safety net. But in terms of the way it is, the way we calculate spending, these programs are sort of separated out because they are so huge, right? So Medicare, Medicaid, and these other programs, the subsidies that people might receive on the marketplace if they're receiving the Affordable Care Act. That's 25% of federal expenditure. So that's a huge chunk.
Yeah.
Got it. So really, so all in, everything, all of the spending that the government does to in some way assist people, sounds like is 60 to 70%. We've got like Social Security plus Medicare, Medicaid, plus this other 8% kind of basket.
Correct.
And Am I getting that right? Okay.
That's right, right. And this is from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. So they have a really nice, they delineate all of this information very succinctly.
Okay, the same question. Yeah, go ahead, Molly. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Yeah, well, so I was going to say, and then in terms of that 8%, right, which is like help children and working families or potentially, how does that compare, that meager number, compared to other countries? Let's say just European countries. That seems to be the most obvious comparison.
I don't have the actual stats, the actual percentage, but I can tell you that other industrialized countries spend much more of the federal budget on things like childcare subsidies, for example. So that in Northern Europe, you know, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, a person could be out of the labor market for up to 3 years to care for their child, and they would be getting paid up to 60 to 70% of their salary to remain at home and care for their child. So in terms of what that is percentage-wise of their expenditures, you know, their national expenditures or GDP, I don't have that figure, but it is vastly more than the United States spends.
So if you are in need in this country and dependent on government assistance, what kind of life do you lead?
A very challenging life, I would say. So one of the really important things about the United States system that I think is really important to try to convey to our fellow human beings who might be listening to this podcast is that in the United States, to qualify for these programs, one can only make approximately less than $13,000 a year is the federal poverty threshold. So if you make more than that, you are unlikely to be eligible for most of these programs, if not all of them. There is some state level variability. Some states will go all the way up to 130% of the federal poverty threshold. But for the most part, we are talking about people who are really enduring significant material hardship to simply be eligible for these programs. Once you might be deemed eligible for the programs, there is something called administrative burden, which is actually built into the programs. And that simply means that in order to receive and maintain eligibility for these programs, you have to demonstrate all the time that your income has not gone above these thresholds. And as you can imagine, that might be very difficult if you're working in a gig economy, for example, if your income fluctuates month to month. And so most of these programs, people find very difficult to get them and to stay on them. It requires an enormous amount of coordination. Programs like TANF, for example, which is Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. It's a cash assistance program. people have to demonstrate that they are working. Sometimes you have to go in and see your caseworker, but you might have had to work during that time. And then you have to, you know, you have to manage your transportation to your caseworker's office to demonstrate that you are working, but that interferes with your ability to work or care for your child. So it is an incredibly complex and challenging way to live. And also, I think also very importantly, the monthly cash amounts that one might receive for this are very, very low and are meant to keep you below the federal poverty threshold.
Wait, say that again?
The amount of money that you would receive, for example, for TANF would be explicitly less than what we would consider the federal poverty threshold. So if, so you say, for example, that the, you know, per month you can only make $1,000, you would receive somewhere, you know, perhaps around, you know, $500 or $600 a month for TANF. Mm. So the point of it is to make sure that you are,
you're eligible for the rest, right?
Yeah. That you are, no, the point of it is actually to incentivize you to go into the labor market because they don't want to give you more money than,
How could I be so silly? Sorry, yes. Yeah, right. Got it. Okay.
I mean, yes. And so what you have then as a result is because there's also a lack of childcare subsidies or universal child care, you have people in this real catch 22, it sounds like, where in some ways they have to be dependent on these systems that don't work very well and are meager to say the least, but can't necessarily, if they have kids, go into the labor market because there's no child care.
Yes. So it presents an incredibly difficult situation, and a situation that has, you know, U.S. poverty policy and U.S. family policy has always been characterized by many of the forms of the profound forms of discrimination that we face in this country, you know, across many domains. So, for example, women and people of color, Black people, are explicitly discriminated against in these you know, welfare programs, but they're so highly stigmatized. They don't tend to work very well for a woman who might be a single parent who would have to maintain her child and try to work and try to find childcare at the same time. TANF in particular has a 60-month lifetime cap. And so that's, you know, that's not that long if you think about sort of the way the vagaries of a capitalist system. You know, economies go up and down. And if you are working in the low wage labor market, you know, 5 years, it doesn't seem like, it seems like a long time sort of on its face. But if you think about how long it might take you to kind of get on your feet at different periods of your life, it is a relatively meager and challenging system to subsist on.
So obviously you're following the debate in Congress as they try to wrangle this $3.5 trillion soft infrastructure bill, a good part of which is human infrastructure. And rather than ask you to comment on the political odds of the thing, which, you know, toss up, right? What difference would some of those programs make? How much of an impact would they have?
I mean, social policy in general, and this bill in particular, are enormously helpful. They are they really keep people out of, they do help to lift people out of poverty. So, for example, you know, like last year, or I'm sorry, in 2018, all of the programs that we were talking about in the beginning, you know, the Earned Income Tax Credit, TANF, SSI, et cetera, unemployment, it lifted about 37 million people out of poverty in 2018. And this is an enormous benefit. So we know that these policy solutions or policy levers actually can be effective if we implement them. And so investing in human capital, investing in education, investing in health would have an enormous impact on the day-to-day lives of our fellow Americans. There's no question about that.
Are we in, do you think, a different moment to be having these conversations because we have this relatively recent data set. You know, we saw the child tax credit reduce child hunger. We saw stimulus payments lift people in some cases out of poverty or keep them in their homes or allow them to spend that money on food. It seems like previously, you know, prior to the pandemic, this was a philosophical and largely political conversation. And now we really have a year's worth, a year and a half worth of proof that helping people helps people. I wonder if that's going to change the conversation at all.
Absolutely. I hope so. One of my favorite writers is the writer Arundhati Roy, and she has said that the pandemic is a portal, meaning it is an opportunity to create the world anew, to create something different and perhaps and hopefully more just. And I just found a study that came out in March of this year that provided some empirical evidence for the idea that three relatively small samples of about, you know, 500 to 1,000 people each. But people in the United States and in the UK actually expressed much more interest or much more support for something called universal basic income. So after the pandemic, people are saying, you know what? We are all vulnerable here. And perhaps we might be interested in providing a real income floor for our fellow human beings. So I do think that there is an opportunity here. There's a policy window here, potentially, to push through these kinds of policy solutions that may have been less palatable previous to the or prior to the pandemic.
That's a hopeful note to end on. Tina Sachs is a professor at UC Berkeley's School of Social Welfare. Thank you so much for the time today.
Thank you so much.
Take good care. Feel better.
Thank you. Thank you.
Summer colds are no fun.
No good. Oh, man. It is so unique to the Bay Area that at the end of September, we're talking about summer colds.
Yeah, right.
Because that's what they are here.
Yeah. Oh, man.
But yes, there you have it.
That was good. I learned stuff.
I know.
Which is kind of wild.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, there's an interesting conversation. I mean, this is, everybody wants to make fun of, I know, people in my neck of the woods, the Silicon Valley types who are like, oh, we need to disrupt this and there needs to be design thinking. But a hugely overlooked part of this, we were actually talking about this recently when we talked about the companies that, you know, put you on hold or call you back at their leisure shouldn't there be some mechanism for you to get your time back? And the time wasting, there was a big piece, an Annie Lowry piece in The Atlantic.
Oh, yeah, the time tax.
The time tax and how that is deliberately built in to dissuade people. And these old systems that are super clunky or maybe they're only online and people can't access them because they don't have internet. I mean, there are so many things other than just the money that go into making these systems accessible to people if we want these systems to be accessible to people. And we don't want kids to starve in America, which literally happens.
Well, the interview ended on a hopeful note. Ms. Wood's commentary did not.
Sorry,
so we'll just take a little. We'll just take a little break right here. Let us know what you think about the interview, about the social safety net, whether you thought it was or not, how it's working, what you think about that. Let us know in an email or a voice memo, makemesmart@marketplace.org, or you can just call us, leave us a voice message. Our new phone number is 508-827-6278. I think we have to stop saying new because we've been saying this for a while.
I was wondering that too.
508-UB-SMART. Push those buttons and talk to us.
And if you haven't already, please subscribe to our podcast. Maybe leave us a rating if you'd prefer that I don't buzzkill the hopeful note. That's fair. That's a fair critique. I can take it. Yeah. Uh-huh. And we'll be right back with the news.
Oh, man. Yeah, buddy.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI.
that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.
All right, we are back to do a little news. Mine is sort of a catch-up on two items from mine, actually, because I got two of them, on a couple of things we've talked about. The first is the Texas abortion law, which we talked about on a Tuesday, actually, about reproductive rights being economic rights. It's worth a note here, in case you missed it late yesterday afternoon, a Texas doctor who admitted in the pages of the Washington Post that he had performed a post-6-week abortion has been sued by, get this, attorneys in Arkansas and Illinois, not in Texas, but Arkansas and Illinois. One of those attorneys, by the way, who is still under the protection of, shall we say, the Federal Bureau of Prisons for a prior crime on his part, has sued this doctor. So I bring that up just for an update, actually, to let you know that this is now actually going to wind its way through the courts and there will be actual hearings as opposed to the shutting down of hearings, which is what happened in the Fifth Circuit and in the Supreme Court that we talked about when this happened. So I thought that was of note. The other follow-up item that I have is a podcast. Perhaps some of you listen, perhaps some of you don't. It's The Daily by The New York Times, and it's a follow-up to a point I made on Friday about the Pentagon's apology for that drone strike in Kabul that went horribly wrong as we were leaving that country. And the Pentagon said, we killed a known ISIS-K terrorist. And it turns out, after some reporting by The New York Times, it was actually a humanitarian aid worker and I think seven children. Mm-hmm. Barbara Oates today, the host of The Daily, talked to their Kabul reporter about how the New York Times did its reporting on the investigation that led the Pentagon to come clean about what had actually happened. It's remarkable. It's infuriating. And it is, just to close the loop on what I said on Friday, it's exactly what happens when you don't have intel on the ground and when you rely on these over-the-horizon systems, which President Biden and the others have said they are going to use. I recommend it very highly. It's really good. Mm. Barbara aside, but that's a whole different thing. Sorry.
Wow, bro.
Sorry. I can't help it. Come on. People say the same thing about us. You know that.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Oh, yes. No, the banter has already gotten exhausting for so many people.
I know.
Yeah. Yes. You know, a comprehensive top-to-bottom review of American intelligence, I think, could be called for. Like, we tend to want to lay this all on the feet, at the feet of any president. And certainly the buck stops with the president. Yep. But if you were like the CEO of an operation that was not functioning very well and kept having lots of failures, it seems to me you would look at that and see if you could fix it up some.
Yep.
So I'm just going to throw that out there.
Totally.
Speaking of the Texas abortion law, which, by the way, I mean, the idea that these anti-choice activists in Texas are now irritated that the lawsuits have been filed in ways that they weren't hoping, including by at least one person who was like, yeah, no, I want this thing to be overturned. And so I sued like that doctor was hoping, is rich. It's really rich. Yep. Like, oh, no, you enabled a bunch of vigilantes and then it didn't go how you thought it was going to go.
Yeah. Yep.
But on that note, Caitlin Myers, who we had on the program when we talked about reproductive rights being economic rights, tweeted yesterday, Monday, that that economists have now filed an amicus brief with the Supreme Court to share evidence on the effects of abortion access. We'll have a link to her tweet and to the brief that they filed with the Supreme Court. And what she tweeted was, economists were silent when Roe was decided in 1973 and again when Casey was decided in 1992. With those precedents hanging in the balance, today we filed our first amicus brief with SCOTUS to share evidence on the effects of abortion access.
It's not all that long. It's a reasonably quick read, update, honestly, for a legal brief.
And obviously, this is not only an economic issue, and we are certainly not trying to suggest that. However, it is, in addition to all of the other issues that it is, an economic issue, especially when we talk about, for example, the thing where children in this country are starving because we won't help them, even if we're willing to force women to give birth to them. Yep. All right, that's all I got. I got some other stuff about mergers and acquisitions, but somehow it just doesn't feel appropriate right now.
All right, let's go.
Let's move on.
Charlton, wake up in there.
Oh, there Hello, Molly and Kyle.
Oh. It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Long-time listener, first-time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
He knows I love him. I kid because I love.
I listen to the afternoon show and like Alvin the chipmunk comes out of the airwaves, I'm going to know why. And I'm going to be like,
I will tell you, he's laughing. I'm not sure if he's driving today, but he's laughing. Oh, man.
This
All right.
is Marketplace.
Oh, my God. Okay.
All right.
You take it
first
from
up.
Here. Oh, my God.
We have a voice memo from Beth in New York in response to last week's episode on the legacy of Occupy Wall Street.
I was 23 at the time, living in New York City, and Occupy Wall Street didn't really speak to me as much as it probably would now, because it was headlined largely by straight white dudes, which, if you'll recall, at the time, 10 years ago, was not a thing that non-straight, non-white, non-dudes were allowed to feel publicly uncomfortable with. Mm-hmm. But the history of social movements is complex and fascinating. So, thank you for making me smart and making me think.
Hmm. Yes, to all that. Totally fascinating. And what's amazing is, I know it's been much longer than this, but the idea that we went from 10 years ago, non-straight, non-white, non-dudes weren't allowed to, you know, express discomfort with this. And now it's, of course, you know?
Totally.
Wow.
I know. I think that is so fascinating.
Yeah.
Anyway, yes. A lot, yes. All of that was fascinating, and you realize that a lot has happened in 10 years. And I'm going to say that on the balance, when it comes to non-straight, non-white, non-dudes feeling more comfortable, on the balance, it's a good thing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, totally. all right. A voice memo from a listener making other people smart. Here we go.
Hey, Kai and Molly. This is Laura out of Los Gatos, California, in the Bay Area. Just wanted to let you know that I was walking with my boyfriend a few weeks back, and we were talking about crazy COVID news, and I was able to educate him on the difference between misinformation and disinformation, thanks to your guys' Make Me Smart podcast. So thanks for that. Even I was kind of surprised that I was able to comprehend and absorb such amazing facts from all the multitasking and fun I have with your guys' podcast. So thank you. Bye.
There you go. That's awesome.
I love how the stuff you never know is going to sinks in.
Right? You never know.
That's outstanding. All right. And finally, we don't want to beat a dead horse, except that we actually do, because jokes get funnier the more you tell them. So here you go.
Hey, y'all. It's Megan from Flower Mountain, Texas. Cannot tell you how pumped I am to have finally made it with a voicemail onto the show. But even more awesome is that you guys probably didn't realize that you played both my mom, Patty, and my voicemail within the same show. So that was pretty awesome. Thanks.
Wow. We're a tight-knit little family here at Make Me Smart. That's all I'm saying.
Ow! Oof. We played it in the same show and we didn't even realize
no
that
clue.
Is amazing.
We had no clue.
Oh, that's outstanding. I think that this is not our only parent and child listening situation. Because we also have the guy whose kid was going to college, or that woman kid was going to college. Yeah.
That's right. Tell
us. All right. If you are one of them, tell us. And you know how we love a duo.
Oh, God.
Send us a duo voicemail.
Oh, man. All right. as we always do end, we end on a Tuesday with a Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew, later found out you were wrong about? Here we go.
Hi, this is Jen calling from Colorado. Something I thought I knew but just very recently learned I was wrong about involves toaster ovens. I always thought that the silly little flat tray that comes with the toaster oven is if I wanted to bake,
two cookies? How useless. I just recently learned it's supposed to live in the bottom of the toaster oven as an easy-to-clean crumb catcher. Who knew? I'm getting smarter every day, including thanks to you folks. Thanks. Keep it up. Bye.
Jen.
Oh, that's amazing. Also, I'm cracking up because that little tray is like the most useful thing in my entire life because I bought a house during the pandemic. It's almost been a year and I have two ovens, which used to be like my dream.
Yeah.
I think I've used them like three times. I only ever use my little toaster oven. It's like one of those little induction ones or I don't know, convection.
Yeah.
And I use that little tray, which is supposed to be a crumb catcher apparently for literally everything. Potatoes, green beans, meatballs.
Now we know.
Too funny. I do have a lot of crumbs down there. See, you never know what you're going to learn. If you have put off emailing or sending us a voice memo with your answer to the Make Me Smart question, wait no longer. Call us. Leave us a voice message. 508-82-SMART. 508-UB-SMART. See you tomorrow.
Man, oh man. Learn something new every day.
Like, literally, they smoke and are going to light on fire. I mean, I clean them out, but... Make Me Smart today was produced by Marissa Cabrera and Mark K. Green. Tony Wagner writes our newsletter, and our intern is Grace Rubin.
Charlton Thorpe engineered the program during the role. Juan Carlos Torrado is going to mix it down later. Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. Bridget Bodner is in charge. Sarah Nieves is actually in charge.
In charge.
Thank God somebody.
This crumb conversation, I just want you all to know, is continuing apace in the Slack.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, well, where do the crumbs go? Were they on the counter? Were on the bottom of the toaster oven? That's why it's always slightly on fire.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.